breaking ball and a call. Strike three. Third strikeout for Zach.
He's going to just watch it go. A grand slam for Bryson Stott.
And there's a high fly ball. Deep right field. Harper watches it fly.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, Phillies take the first two games against the Nationals. Game three of this series to be played on Thursday. But we're recording this here on Wednesday night, and the Phillies, by taking the first two games, win their second series in a row. Four wins in a row for the team, coming off a five-game losing streak. So the Phillies righting the ship a little bit against a really awful pitching staff of the Washington Nationals. So we'll get to the first couple of games. We also have reached the end of April, so we'll give you an April recap on the Phillies' season here so far in 2025. We'll talk about some of the defensive issues the Phillies are having and potential solutions, maybe some crazy potential solutions. And the Phillies have announced that they're going to be retiring some more, well, they're not retiring their numbers, but some players' names, likenesses are going to be retired. We'll get to all that coming up here in just a couple of minutes. Plus, I'm going to answer just a couple of emails at the end of the show. The emails have been stacking up a little bit, so we'll get to that here in just a couple of minutes on Hittin' Season. But before we jump into the show, I just mentioned that we're going to be taking some emails, answering some email bag questions here. You can send us an email. Tell us your thoughts on the Phillies. If you have any questions, things you want to talk about, things you want us to know, you can email us to hittinseason@billypenn.com. Really easy email address to remember, hittinseason@billypenn.com. And also, I will remind you that if you want to get your voice on the show, you want to become a more part of an interactive part of the show, record a voice memo on your phone and email that voice memo to hittinseason@billypenn.com. We'll play it on the show and we'll respond. So it seems like a really good way for you to take part in the show. We're not talk radio, so we can't head to the phones. You know, we can't do that. We don't have the ability to do that here right now. This is the next best thing. You can just, again, record a voice memo on your iPhone or whatever it is and email it, hittinseason@billypenn.com. You can also send us normal emails as well, too. We will take care of all that. And of course, if you missed the roundtable edition of the podcast, you can always catch it on YouTube. All of our roundtable podcasts are up on YouTube the day after. So you could go to YouTube and do a search for Hittin' Season, and you will find all of our YouTube stuff there as well. All right, Phillies versus Nationals. First two games. Phils have their most normal win of the season, maybe, on Wednesday night, 7-2. One night after their first truly wild game of the 2025 season on Tuesday night, that they won 7-6. And with those two wins, the Phillies finish April at 17-13. That's a 91 win pace, .567 winning percentage. It's the seventh best winning percentage at the end of April for this team since the year 2000. And if you're doing the math, that's 26 seasons. So seventh best out of 26 seasons, not too bad. And following losses by the Mets and the Braves here on Wednesday, the Phillies are 3.5 games behind the Mets for first place in the National League East. And the Braves, they've been playing better baseball, but they're still three back of the Phillies. But Atlanta, look out. They're starting to get the ball rolling a little bit there in Atlanta. Speaking of getting the ball rolling, the Phillies finally broke out the long ball on Wednesday night. A Kyle Schwarber three-run home run in the first inning off of Jake Irvin, as well as solo shots by Max Kepler and JT Realmuto, paced the offense here. We're kind of seeing why the Phillies wanted Schwarber to hit cleanup some nights. That first inning bomb brought home three runs, not just one, right? I mean, you get Kyle Schwarber up in the first inning and he's leading off. That's a solo shot, but you know, you got him hitting in the four hole. The first two guys got on. Stott and Turner get on. Harper flies out and Kyle Schwarber goes yardo. Really kind of an interesting home run swing too. The wind was really kind of blowing out and the ball was carrying pretty well. Schwarber just kind of one-armed it, but he's country strong, you know, big, tall, strong boy. Got that ball out of there in a hurry. So the Phillies are up 3-0. A very nice way to ease Christopher Sanchez into his first start in a week and a half after he was dealing with a very worrisome forearm soreness. Thankfully, that has turned out to be nothing. He appears healthy. He looked good in his five innings of work, gave up just two runs, got a bunch of swings and misses. The fastball is around 94, 95. He wasn't throwing it quite as hard as he had been, like 97, 98 miles an hour, but 94, 95 is right about where he was all of last year, and the changeup was still generating a bunch of swings and misses. So more than anything else, Christopher Sanchez looked like himself. He seems healthy, not complaining of anything after the game. So, but you know, went the five innings. I didn't want to push him here in his first start back, which I think was really smart. And I don't think he was pushing it as hard as he could, certainly with the velocity. So again, this is just a nice normal win. You got a decent start from your starter. The bullpen guys did the job on this night, and the offense gave you plenty of runs to work with. Three home runs, seven runs total. You know, this is just one of those kind of a cookie cutter win, but we haven't had many of these this year. These normie wins are like unicorns for this baseball team. So really nice to see on Wednesday night, the Phillies winning the second game of this series against the Nats to clinch the series win. They'll go for the sweep on Thursday. I do want to talk about the game on Tuesday. This ridiculous baseball game these two teams played. Again, the Phillies winning this one in walk-off fashion in the bottom of the ninth, 7-6. But the win probability meter was pinning both sides wildly late in this one. The Phillies had a 3-0 lead in this game. Entering the eighth inning, the Nats had chipped away for a couple of runs, and the Phillies led 3-2. The Phillies' win probability entering the eighth inning was 75%, according to Baseball Savant. Trey Turner and Jose Alvarado allow the bases to get loaded with nobody out. That win percentage dropped to 38%. But Jose Alvarado performs a Houdini act and strikes out the side after getting the bases loaded with nobody out. That win percentage went up to 87%. And by the way, that ridiculous job by Jose Alvarado in that eighth inning to strike out the side after loading the bases with nobody out. The first time since July of 1968 that a Phillies pitcher struck out three straight batters with the bases loaded in the eighth inning or later, according to the Elias Sports Bureau. Dick Hall did it against the Mets with the Phillies trailing by two in the top of the ninth. Dick Allen eventually won that game thanks to Dick Hall's heroics in the ninth inning with a three-run home run in the bottom of the ninth. Of course, you all remember where you were July 7th, 1968 when Dick Allen walked it off after Dick Hall managed to strike out the side after loading the bases with nobody out half an inning before. I mean, the tension, pulse-pounding drama at Shibe Park. Alvarado also became just the second pitcher in the last 35 years to strike out three batters with the bases loaded to protect a one-run lead in the eighth inning or later. The only other player to do that, Devin Williams, did it for the Brewers in April of 2022. The Phillies, after that Alvarado eighth inning, feeling strong, score two insurance runs in the eighth, giving them a win probability of 99%. But then the Phillies' defense and Orion Kerkering enter the picture. Johan Rojas. First of all, yeah, Johan Rojas allows an RBI double on a ball hit right at him. I mean, the ball should have been put in his pocket. An easy catch for an above-average center fielder. A guy who's played center fielder for years should make that catch easy. I mean, it looked like it was hit right at him. I don't even know how he missed it. I still don't know how he missed it. But the ball went all the way to the wall, made it a 5-3 game. And then Trey Turner boots an easy ground ball that, again, if Rojas makes that catch and Turner doesn't throw wildly to first base to allow the runner to reach first, game's over. Those are two outs. It's three out. That's your three outs, and that's your ball game. And everybody's hopping in their cars, and they are heading home happy that the Phillies won 5-2. But then they wouldn't have had the drama that they could tell their family and friends about later, because Nathaniel Lowe takes advantage of those two mistakes and hits a go-ahead three-run home run. The Nationals come all the way back and take a 6-5 lead in the top of the ninth inning. The Phillies' win probability drops from 99%. There was a 1% chance they were going to lose this game. It takes it all the way down to 19%. 81% chance the Phillies are losing this game. They went from 1% chance of losing to 81% chance of losing. And then our hero, Kyle Finnegan, comes in to rescue the day. He really, I mean, there are some games he does pretty well against the Phillies, but he has blown a number of games against the Phillies, and that is exactly what he did in the bottom of the ninth inning. The Phillies rally for two runs with great base running in this game. A real gutsy call by Dusty Wathan in the bottom of the ninth inning. With Alec Bohm on third base and one out, Johan Rojas hits a fly ball to medium right field. Dylan Cruz has a good arm out there. But Dusty Wathan sent him anyway because the way this team struggles to hit with runners in scoring position and two outs, it was not likely that Trey Turner was going to come through with a hit in that spot after Johan Rojas, even though Turner had already gotten four hits on the day. They just don't produce in that situation. So Wathan said, you know what, son? Do it. He's going to have to make a perfect throw and then a perfect tag to beat you. And Dylan Cruz and Keibert Ruiz couldn't do it. The throw bounces away from Ruiz. Bohm would have been out if Ruiz had caught the ball, but he couldn't corral it. Bohm scores the tying run, and then a couple of pitches later with Trey Turner at the plate, Bryson Stott sitting on third base. Wild pitch didn't get very far past Keibert Ruiz, but Bryson Stott with an aggressive move towards home as the pitch was being thrown so that he was able with momentum to race towards home plate. He slid head first, got his hand stepped on by Finnegan as he tried to cover the plate. Thankfully, it wasn't serious. Stott scores the winning run. The Phillies' win probability goes to 100% as they walk it off and win 7-6 in what was truly the craziest game of the year. These two bullpens rank 29th and 30th in Major League Baseball. The Phillies have the second worst bullpen. The Nationals have the worst bullpen. And we saw that play out on Tuesday night at Citizens Bank Park. I mean, that is exactly the way that all went down. But the Nationals are not a good baseball team. The pitching staff is dreadful. There's some decent talent in this lineup. You can see it when you watch the Nationals play. But this pitching staff, starting rotation, aside from Mackenzie Gore, who the Phillies did take advantage of early in this game, but Gore limited the damage. He's a good young pitcher. They just don't have anything in the bullpen. You think as bad as the Phillies bullpen is, the Nationals, I think, are like a run and a half worse than the Phillies right now. So you feel good about being able to come back against the Nationals if you're trailing early in this game. But the Phillies are, after struggling offensively for much of the season so far, they are getting right against the Nationals, just like they did in the first series of the season. The Phillies offense taking advantage of a terrible Nationals pitching staff. All right, we have reached the end of April. This game here on Wednesday night was the final game for the Phillies this month. And so let's do a little bit of an April recap here on Hit and Season. Who has been the Phillies MVP so far this year through April? The leader in the clubhouse at the moment is probably Bryson Stott, who in the month of April, we're not counting the March stats for Bryson Stott's numbers here, but a .300 batting average in the month of April. He went 30 for 100. He hit two home runs, had 15 RBIs, seven stolen bases, and an .871 OPS. All told on the season, he is tops on the Phillies in wins above replacement at 1.1. He's played great defense. He has been the team's outstanding leadoff hitter against right-handed starters, allowing them to move Kyle Schwarber down in the lineup. And he's been really good in the leadoff spot. I read a couple of numbers on the last podcast about Bryson Stott's numbers in the leadoff spot. And he is not hitting every ball like a rocket, but he's muscling balls into right field, left field. He's taking what the pitcher gives him. He's drawing walks. He's seeing a lot of pitches per plate appearance. Bryson Stott has been truly a revelation here in 2025, looking more like the 2023 version that we saw, and clearly feeling healthier here in 25. Just a great start to the season. And I think right now, Bryson Stott is your Phillies MVP through the first month plus of the season. He has been their best player, their most consistent performer, their smartest player so far here in 2025. I don't think there's any question that Bryson Stott has been the Phillies MVP so far. I think he's their only all-star position player at the moment. He's the only one who has put up all-star caliber numbers at his position. None of the other Phillies regulars have good enough numbers to be an all-star right now. Now, that can, of course, change. We have to go May and June and part of July. And we know with Bryce Harper last year, He did not have great April numbers. They were better than the April numbers of this year, but they were not great. But then he won back-to-back Player of the Month honors in May and June. So other Phillies position players could step up. But for right now, Bryson Stott is the only all-star in terms of a position player, and he is this team's most valuable player through the month of April. Now, Kyle Schwarber is not far behind. Schwarber has gotten the power bat going in these two games against the Nationals now that he's returned back to Citizens Bank Park. He was very hot the first 2 weeks of the season, and then his home run stroke abandoned him at some point over the last few weeks. But it has returned with home runs in each of the last two games. He leads the Phillies through the first month of the season in home runs with 9. If you prorate that over a full season, figuring this is a six-month season, you're talking 54 home runs for Kyle Schwarber. We would take that for sure. 23 RBIs for Schwarber, as well as 21 runs scored. And even as the designated hitter, his 0.9 Fangraphs wins above replacement is second on the team. Trey Turner offensively is definitely heating up. Now, he has not had the kind of extra base hit impact that I think the Phillies were hoping for, but he came into the season saying he really wanted to focus, especially if he was going to be hitting at the top of the lineup, at getting on base. And Turner has been doing a good job of that, especially of late. Did not have a great game on Wednesday. Not a bad game, just didn't do anything. Not like the four-hit game that he had on Tuesday. So his batting average is a team-best 282 so far on the season with a 363 on-base percentage. If you're hitting at the top of the lineup or number two, that's pretty good. In terms of overall offense at his position, though, it's barely been above league average according to weighted runs created. He's got a 106 weighted runs created. That's a sabermetric number where if you are at 100 weighted runs created plus, you're seen as being an average offensive player. A 106 number means you are essentially 6% above league average at your position offensively. It's a bunch of numbers. They throw it into a blender. They churn out that number. It's what you get. But I do find that the weighted runs created number, maybe even more so than OPS, kind of tells the story and accurately gauges who has been the best offensively at that position during the course of a season. In one of these future podcasts, I'll get into the definition of some of these sabermetric numbers that I use. In terms of wins above replacement, Trey Turner at 0.7. Fangraphs, wins above replacement, third on the team. Bryce Harper, a middling first month for him. 234 batting average, 370 on base percentage. He's been getting on base a ton, but a 423 slugging percentage with 5 home runs. I've written a lot about Bryce Harper this week. If you go to thegoodfight.com, you will see my Bryce Harper article with some really interesting numbers. Going back to July 1st, Harper has hit 15 home runs and knocked in 45 runs over his last 97 games. That was before Tuesday and Wednesday night. So before his last 99 games, and those numbers haven't changed. He hasn't hit any home runs, and he hasn't driven anybody in over the last couple of nights. That prorates to 25 homers and 75 RBIs over a 162-game season. So basically, since July 1st of last year, he's been on like a 25 homer per season, 75 RBIs per season rate over a 162-game season. The 15 home runs he's hit over his last 97 games since July 1st last year are tied for 50th out of 140 qualified hitters during that stretch. The 45 RBIs tie him for 77th out of 140 qualified hitters, bottom half. And his 804 OPS since July 1st of last year is tied for 40th. His 2.3 wins above replacement was tied with Otto Lopez, Mason Wynn, Willie Adames, Ian Happ, and Randy Arozarena for 48th. That's the kind of player Bryce Harper has been. Those names right there, that's essentially what Bryce Harper has been since July 1st of last year. Now, if you're Nick Castellanos, those numbers are probably pretty fine. But actually, since July 1st of last year, Castellanos has been more productive. His 811 OPS is higher than Harper's 804. He's hit the same number of home runs, 15, and has 14 more RBIs than Harper does over that stretch. Now, Harper has more wins above replacement because he is a far superior defender at first base than Castellanos is in right field. But my whole point for writing the article was that Bryce Harper is this team's Aaron Judge, Bobby Witt Jr., Shohei Ohtani, Francisco Lindor, LA De La Cruz. Like, that's the guy. Harper is the guy. He's the superstar. And he just hasn't hit like a superstar. And it's not just this season. It's going back to July 1st of last year. And he had this flare-up a week ago. We talked about it on the last podcast with the 3 homers in 4 games. And it disappeared as quickly as it came. As quickly as it came, it went away again. So that's why the Bryce Harper numbers are a little disappointing. The on-base percentage is great, but you need him to be a run producer in the number 3 spot in the lineup. He hit a double on Wednesday, and that was great to see. More extra base hits from Bryce Harper are fantastic. I have no doubt Harper will get hot at some point this year. The only question is for how long. They need a sustained hot streak from Bryce Harper. He's the superstar. That's what they need. So I would say it's been a pretty middling first month here for the Phillies' big superstar. Max Kepler. I don't know what to feel about Max Kepler's first month. The numbers are okay. He's been hitting better over the course of the last 4 or 5 games. Now up to .253 with the batting average, a .343 on base, which is good. .411 slugging, a .110 weighted runs created plus. He has a higher weighted runs created than Trey Turner does, folks, with 3 home runs so far this year. Again, he went deep on Wednesday. JT Realmuto has hit into some really bad luck this year, and that's really dragging down his overall numbers because they're not good. .237, .308, .361 with 85 weighted runs created. So a below league average catcher offensively for JT Realmuto, which is kind of hard to believe. Nick Castellanos batting .270 with a .328 on base and a .423 slugging, a .108 weighted runs created, 3 homers, 16 RBIs, and Alec Bohm. Again, he's been hitting better as well, but he started off in such a hole. He's bringing these numbers up, .221, .252, .274, still a negative .0.4 wins above replacement for Alec Bohm through the first month of the season. Who has been the Phillies' best starter? Hands down, Jesus Luzardo. 1.4 Fangraphs wins above replacement. According to Baseball Reference, his 1.6 wins above replacement is tops in baseball. According to Fangraphs, he's third in baseball. He has a 1.73 ERA and a 2.01 FIP. Zach Wheeler, not too far behind, a 1.0 Fangraphs wins above replacement, but the ERA much higher, 3.48 and a 3.31 FIP. Christopher Sanchez has been a strikeout machine. We've seen him have some amazing starts here so far this year. Missed a little bit of time, but a 3.45 ERA and a 3.59 FIP. And then Aaron Nola has looked good his last couple of starts, looked very good against the Cubs in Chicago on Sunday Night Baseball. The ERA still high, 5.40, but it came down by a full run on Sunday night. And the FIP also down by about a run to 4.31. Of course, we all know that the biggest problem for this team so far in the month of April has been the bullpen. There have been 2 reliable starters for the Phillies in the bullpen. And of course, Jose Alvarado has been an absolute dream. I said during the offseason, the Phillies were coming into this year with the hope and really relying on Jose Alvarado to recapture what he had in 2022 and 2023. I wasn't sure they were going to get it, but he is delivering. I mean, what a start to the season Alvarado has had. He is, along with Bryson Stott, probably, and Jesus Luzardo would probably be the third Phillies all-star. And maybe you'd probably throw Zach Wheeler in there as well. But Jose Alvarado absolutely has pitched incredible so far this year, averaging 99.6 miles an hour on his fastball, gang. Averaging 99.6 miles an hour on his fastball, a 1.84 ERA, 1.51 FIP. All of the other numbers look great for him. He certainly passes the eye test. Matt Strom, the only other reliever that's really producing so far this year, a 3.0 ERA, but a 1.41 fielding independent pitching. The velocity has been down, but he had some issues in the spring. He was still kind of working his way back. The fastball was 93, 94 miles an hour in the game on Tuesday. where he gave up a couple of hits, but threw a couple balls right down the middle. Just the command still isn't totally there for Strom, but he's been very good so far this season in 12 innings, averaging 12 strikeouts per nine. The walk rate is a little bit high. That's the only issue with Matt Strom right now. Hasn't been quite as dominant as last year, but interestingly, has the same Fangraphs wins above replacement as Jose Alvarado. Isn't that strange? He's yet to give up a home run this year, and that is part of the deal for Matt Strom. The rest of the bullpen, it's not been good. Tanner Banks, actually, yeah, all right, I'm going to say, I'm surprised how good Tanner Banks' numbers are, because I just haven't seen much of him. He's kind of always in games when nothing's really happening. A 3.37 ERA in 12 games for Tanner Banks, and a 2.56 fielding independent pitching, averaging more than a strikeout per nine, better walk rate than Matt Strom so far. So the Phillies' three left-handed starters have the best numbers in the bullpen. The problem, and I wrote about this for The Good Fight last week, is right-handed relief pitching. It is the worst in baseball. The Phillies' right-handers in the bullpen have been the worst in baseball, and it's reflected in the strikeout numbers. The strikeout numbers and the walk numbers are ghastly, but listen to these numbers. Joe Ross, who we haven't seen in a while, 5.02 ERA, 4.13 FIP, averaging a little over 6.3, or a little under 6.3 strikeouts per nine. Like, he's not getting any strikeouts in 14 and a third innings. Orion Kerkering has really underperformed here. A 5.56 ERA and a 5.02 FIP. I'm not blaming him for Tuesday night as much as I am Turner and Rojas. He got the outs he needed to get the save. He's still throwing, averaging 97.7 miles an hour on his fastball, and yet he just can't seem to find the right way to sequence his pitches, his fastball and his sweeper, and locate them. He just can't figure it out. And he made a bad pitch to Nathaniel Lowe on Tuesday night, putting that ball down and into a left-hander. That is a lefty's nitro zone. The command is not there. He's given up a ton of home runs, 8.7 strikeouts per nine, 4.76 walks per nine innings. It's not looking good for Orion Kerkering so far this year. Jose Ruiz, kind of the same story. Almost identical numbers to Orion Kerkering. The same exact strikeouts per nine, same exact walks per nine, same exact home runs per nine. They've both pitched 11 and a third innings. Jose Ruiz has a 4.76 ERA and a 5.02 FIP, same FIP as Orion Kerkering. Carlos Hernandez, who they brought on just to be like kind of a mop-up guy, it's exactly what he's done, a 6.55 ERA and a 6.17 FIP, 6.5 strikeouts per nine. For a guy who throws 97.5 miles an hour on average, how are you averaging 6.55 strikeouts per nine and walking almost 5.8 batters per nine innings? Like, what are you doing, Carlos Hernandez? And of course, Jordan Romano, we all know the struggles he's had, a 12.19 ERA, 6.95 FIP. He did look better in his last outing. Very confident 1-2-3 inning against the Cubs on Sunday night. Did not pitch on Tuesday and did not pitch on Wednesday either. He will almost certainly pitch in the series finale against the Nationals on Thursday. A couple other notes. I was kind of thinking about it. Oh, and one other thing about the pitching staff. Did you know the Phillies have not made a single roster move with their pitching staff all season? The same 13 pitchers that broke camp are still on the roster. Just kind of weird. A lot of teams have had to make a bunch of pitching moves. You know, guys go down, guys are ineffective, you move guys around. Even as ineffective as some of the Phillies' relievers have been, there haven't been any obvious solutions, so they've just kind of left them in place. So here, through the first month plus of the season, the Phillies have not made a single change to their pitching staff. Hopefully that pays dividends as the year goes along. The Phillies have won two series against the Nationals, and one each against the Rockies, Dodgers, Marlins, and Cubs. Some good series wins in there against the Dodgers and the Cubs. Nationals, Rockies, and Marlins are all among the worst teams in baseball. The Phillies have lost series against the Braves, just as the Braves are starting to turn things around. The Cardinals, the Giants, and the Mets. Four decent teams, I think. And the Phillies have lost series. So four series losses, six series wins for the Phillies so far this season. They end the month again on a four-game winning streak after suffering a five-game losing streak right before that. Their best win of April, you could point to Tuesday night's game against the Nationals. I'm going to go with their 8-7 win back a couple of weeks ago. Series finale against the Dodgers at Citizens Bank Park. Remember this day? Kind of a rainy Sunday afternoon. Tyler Glasnow's on the mound. He gets the start. He acts like he's never pitched in wet weather before. He melts down, walks the bases loaded. The Dodgers take a 2-0 lead, but he gives up two runs, loads the bases. They pull him. Nick Castellanos hits a grand slam in the third inning to give the Phillies a 6-2 lead, and we're feeling pretty good about things. The Dodgers start to poke away. Teoscar Hernandez has 5 RBIs in this game. He almost single-handedly brings the Dodgers back, and the Dodgers take a 7-6 lead in the seventh off of Romano and Kirkering. But the Phillies answer with 2 in the bottom of the seventh, thanks to a Harper leadoff double, a walk to Max Kepler, a Castellanos groundout, a Stott RBI single, and then Sosa hits an RBI groundout, beats out a double play ball, the go-ahead run scores. Phillies end up winning that game 7-6. They take 2 out of 3 from the Dodgers, a big series win at home at Citizens Bank Park, gave the team some confidence there. Loved that win, especially the Tyler Glasnow meltdown in the third inning. Glad they were able to actually turn that into a victory after it looked like they were going to choke that game away. Their worst loss of April, it's got to be that 4-3 loss in the series finale to the Mets in 10 innings on April 23rd. It's 2-2 in the 10th. Castellanos gets an RBI single to score the zombie runner, but the Phillies load the bases with 1 out in the 10th with a chance to break it open, and they can't score any more. Jordan Romano comes in, starts freaking out about having the guy on second base behind him in a one-run game. Pete Alonso hits an RBI double. The Mets end up scoring 2 in the bottom of the 10th inning. The Phillies cannot avoid the sweep. They get humiliatingly swept away by the Mets in New York. That, to me, was the worst loss of the season so far. The worst loss of April, that 4-3 loss, as the Phillies were just trying to save a little bit of face before they left New York and head to Chicago with a little bit of a pep in their step. Felt like maybe they would get it after scoring a run in the 10th. But those batting average with runners in scoring position numbers came back to haunt them again, and they lose 4-3. But that's kind of a recap on your first month of April. One of the things I did want to mention before we move to the mailbag was the Phillies' defense, and I talked a little bit about it because it was a major component for why they almost lost on Tuesday, and specifically Trey Turner at shortstop and Johan Rojas in center field. As a team, the Phillies came into Wednesday with negative 15 defensive runs saved. That is third worst in baseball. But they're 17th in outs above average at 0, and 23rd in Fangraph's overall defensive rankings. These are not good numbers, kids. According to StatCast's fielding run value and runs above average, this includes throwing and blocking and framing and arm and range, the Phillies rank 20th. In terms of defensive runs saved, Turner is at negative 5 at shortstop, Bohm's negative 4. Brandon Marsh in center field is at negative 3. Schwarber, in the limited time he's played in the outfield, is negative 2. And Bryson Stott actually at negative 2. See, that's the thing with defensive metrics. They're all a little bit hinky. But the eye test tells you that this defense, specifically Trey Turner and Johan Rojas, are not playing well defensively. And I think we're starting to see, I know that I'm starting to hear more rumbling about at some point soon, unless Trey Turner figures things out defensively at shortstop, they're going to have to move him off of that spot. He's costing the team outs, runs, and sometimes even games with his glove. And I think it's affecting his offense. I think one of the reasons he's been struggling on offense a little bit is he's taking some of his defensive issues to the plate with him. Or maybe it's vice versa. But I don't know that you can do anything with Trey Turner in season. I know Bryce Harper learned a new position in season. You might be able to do it. And the solution would seem to be to move Trey Turner to center field, get Johan Rojas off the field. I'm done with Johan Rojas in center field. This supposedly elite defensive center fielder, who in 2023 was an elite defensive center fielder by every metric that's out there. And since then, in 2024 and 25. He has been league average to below league average defensively in center field. He has made a number of miscues. We talked about some of them on the last podcast. He's made a number of defensive miscues that have cost his team outs, runs, and games. So what do you do? I know that some are floating the idea of moving Trey Turner to center field and having Edmundo Sosa, who is a far superior defensive shortstop, take over at shortstop, have Trey Turner go out to center field. Maybe you improve your offense at center field, and you don't lose a whole lot, maybe, with Sosa at shortstop. Now, I think Sosa would be exposed playing every day, at least offensively, but defensively, he would certainly shore up the middle of the infield, shore up that middle infield defense. But I think it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to ask Trey Turner to learn a new position like center field on the fly here and expect his offensive numbers to continue on the way they are, or for him to improve offensively. I don't think it's fair to ask that. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. I would be all for moving Trey Turner to center field and moving Edmundo Sosa as making him the everyday shortstop if I thought that Turner would handle the switch and his offensive numbers would not suffer. I'm just not sure. It seems like the offseason is a better time for that to happen. But I will say this. If this continues, and there's every reason to believe Turner's defensive issues are not going to work themselves out. To his credit, he worked really hard in the spring. We read all the stories about how hard he was working this spring to improve his defense, to become a more well-rounded player, to make it so that his glove was a plus and not a minus. It's never going to be a plus. The one thing you could hope for is that he would be making the routine plays. But there have been, and there will continue to be, moments where Trey Turner just doesn't make the routine play. Just screws the pooch. And if it's costing them games as the season moves along, I don't see how you can't make the switch. I'm sure they're talking about it. And maybe in pregame warmups, Trey Turner's out there shagging flies in center. Maybe they're doing real drills with him, you know, out of the spotlight. But they couldn't hide Bryce Harper taking grounders at first base. So I don't think you'd be able to hide Trey Turner learning center field. I just don't know that it would. I don't know that Trey Turner would react favorably to that at the plate if he was trying to learn a new position. But you could also make the argument that he's carrying the defensive issues to the plate with him, and maybe moving him off of shortstop and into center field would help him at the plate. Take something off his mind, ease the burden a little bit. I don't know. I'm not ready to pull the trigger on that yet, but if things don't change and Trey Turner is in his early 30s, he's not going to get more athletic as time goes along. He's not going to get better defensively as time goes along. It's going to get worse. And we may be getting to a place where it's untenable. Then I think you're going to have to do something at some point. Maybe this season. We will see. And Johan Rojas in center field, it kills two birds with one stone. If you can, I think Turner's athletic enough. He played center field in the minors. He's athletic enough to play center field. There's no doubt about it. And so if he can make the switch, if he can do it seamlessly, then I'd be all for making the switch right now. I think that's the future. Trey Turner either in left or center field in 2026. I don't know that we're going to see it here in 2025. All right, the Phillies did announce on Wednesday that they're going to be, it's not retiring numbers, because Hall of Famers Ed Delahanty, Billy Hamilton, and Sam Thompson will be honored posthumously. Obviously, they played in the 1800s, so if they were still around, it would be really gruesome, ahead of Thursday night's game against the Nationals. So each will have their names go up alongside the other Phillies greats on the brick wall in Ashburn Alley. They're not having their numbers retired, because when they played in the late 1800s for the Phillies, there were no uniform numbers. So in place of uniform numbers, the club said the insignias from their respective eras will go up on the wall above their names instead. So it's kind of like a number retirement ceremony, just without the number. In case, again, for those of you who want to challenge yourself, give yourself a couple of seconds to see if you can think of the seven Phillies whose numbers have been retired by the team. Jackie Robinson's number 42 has been retired all across baseball, of course, but there have been seven Phillies whose numbers have been retired. Most of you all know these numbers if you're Phillies fans, and certainly longtime Phillies fans like I am. Richie Ashburn's number one. Jim Bunning's number 14. Dick Allen's 15. That's new because he was inducted into the Hall of Fame last year. Mike Schmidt's number 20. Steve Carlton's 32. Roy Halladay's number 34. And Robin Roberts' number 36. Which other Phillies should have their numbers retired? I have a few that I think absolutely should be retired. I think Chase Utley's numbers should be retired. I think no one should ever wear Jimmy Rollins' number again. I think Ryan Howard's number should be retired. I think Cole Hamels' number should be retired. And I think eventually Bryce Harper's number will be retired by this team. You might see Zach Wheeler's number retired by this team at some point. But they only do Hall of Famers. A lot of those guys are not going to make the Hall of Fame. Ryan Howard, certainly not. Utley and Rollins, they're still on the fence. Utley will probably get in. Rollins, kind of iffy. Hamels, iffy. Harper will probably be a Hall of Famer someday when all is said and done. So I think a lot of those numbers are locks to be retired by the team at a certain point. All right, let's get to the mailbag. We haven't done a mailbag in a little bit. And again, you can send mailbag questions or comments. A couple of these are comments rather than questions to hittinseason@billypenn.com. And again, a voice memo, record it on your phone, and email that voice memo to hittinseason@billypenn.com. We'll play it on the podcast. All right. First one is from John Higgins. John asked, what do you think about trying to buy low on Luis Robert Jr. early this season? He's off to a terrible start, but he probably has next to zero motivation playing on the South Side these days, and the White Sox literally need help at every position. Would a package of either Marsh or Rojas, Seth Johnson or Mick Abel, Michael Mercado, Otto Kemp, and either Gabriel Rincones or Justin Crawford get it done for Luis Robert Jr.? He says, does that move the needle at all? I have to figure that Chicago had been holding out for some Wild Kings ransom, but Lou isn't playing into that scenario. If he's still this bad in July, my proposal might even be an overpay. However, if he comes here and turns his season around, it's a bargain. A right-handed bat with speed and legit center field ability for likely several more seasons turns this team around. And while he surely will be looking for a big-time deal, even a half a good a season probably doesn't earn him that. So a one-year prove-it deal like $20 to $25 million wouldn't be ridiculous, and it gets 1 3/4 seasons of his service for a reasonable dollar amount and a few prospects that may or may not pan out. Am I crazy, or has 19 years of career mode in MLB The Show put me on the right track? Thanks to the crew for keeping me connected to my Phillies despite having had to move to Texas. Cheers, y'all. John Higgins. John, thank you for that email. Glad you're listening to us in Texas. Tell your other Texas Phillies friends about Hittin' Season as well, but really, really thrilled that you're listening to us in the Lone Star State. Here's the deal with Luis Robert Jr. I don't think that there's any motivation on the part of the Phillies to move him, and I think this is too much for the Phillies to pay for Luis Robert Jr. Right now, Luis Robert Jr. is damaged goods. You mentioned, and you admitted in your email, that he's playing really poorly. The numbers speak for themselves. He is hitting 158 on the season with a 283 on base percentage and a 305 slugging percentage. He has an OPS of 588, OPS plus of 72. He does lead the American League in stolen bases. He has 4 home runs and 9 RBIs on the season, but just 2 doubles. 6 extra base hits on the season so far in 115 plate appearances. 0.4 wins above replacement. So the defensive WAR is okay. But this is a guy who is striking out at a very high rate, 30.4%. It was 33.2% a year ago. The walk rate, way up this year. That's good to see. A 193 batting average on balls in play, that's also good to see. So there are some things there that maybe you can talk yourself into, but I think the price you offered there is a little too rich for my blood, but I also don't think from the White Sox standpoint, there's no star there to gravitate towards. I mean, I guess Justin Crawford is the headliner. It depends what you think of Mick Abel and his start to the season. He's having a good start to the season in AAA. Remember, they're turning Seth Johnson into a reliever. When John wrote this email, Seth Johnson was still in the starting rotation. I mean, there's a lot of folks there. There's just not a high impact player there, except for maybe Justin Crawford. Even so, I don't think this is a deal the Chicago White Sox would do, and I'm pretty darn sure it's a deal the Phillies wouldn't do, just because I don't think there's any interest in Luis Robert Jr. right now. I love the idea. I love the name. But he's just not playing well. I think he'd be bringing in a losing player to this team. You mentioned the motivation. If you can't get motivated to play for the sake of playing and for your own reputation, you're not going to be a value added to this roster. So consider me soured on Luis Robert Jr., but thank you very much for the email question. Diana Strickler emailed to us. Hi, I listened to your latest podcast. This is a couple of weeks ago. She said, I've been watching a lot of the games. She says, I guess I don't have a question, but it's helpful to vent a little bit. So let us all vent together with Diana, everybody. The anemic hitting is very troubling. Both Turner and Rojas struck out on balls on 3-2 pitches. Since we do see our pitchers getting swings on those type of pitches, I have to assume it's really hard to read some of those pitches, especially when you have to protect the plate. Diana, that's exactly right. That said, it's quite clear that opposing teams emphasize pitching breaking balls to the Phillies. We're known as a fastball-hitting team, so there is a specific weakness which needs to be addressed. Very much so. We saw this in the playoffs last year, Diana, against the Diamondbacks in the NLCS. They got the Phillies to chase and chase and chase and chase, breaking pitches out of the strike zone. Diana says, I also like Brandon Marsh, but I'm starting to give up on him. He's not hitting the ball hard on the few occasions when he makes contact. He freezes on balls right over the plate and swings at the breaking balls. I don't think he showed much in spring training either. I also haven't liked Harper's approach much. He walks a lot, but is also striking out too much. The vibe would improve a lot if he started hitting the way we expect. That's a really good point about the vibe and Harper's offense. When Harper's hitting, he brings a different vibe to the team, and there's a different confidence level about the team. I agree with that 100%, Diana. That's an aspect to Harper's milquetoast start to April that I think we don't talk about a whole lot. Like, as the superstar, he's the driving force. He's the engine. And the engine right now is just kind of puttering along like a Hyundai Elantra. You know, it's not, you know, there's no Corvette there right now. Diana continues, I've looked at some other rosters. The Nats have some great young players. The Brewers have Jackson Churio, who just turned 21. I can only hope that some of our minor leaguers, such as Aiden Miller, actually turn into stars. You and me both, Diana. She says, finally, I think the Phillies should have figured out a way to sign Jeff Hoffman. The bullpen is not deep enough, in my opinion. Thanks for a great podcast, Diana Strickler, a fan since 1965. I assume she means a fan of the Phillies since 1965. The podcast has not been around quite that long. Great email from Diana. Lots of great stuff there. I think she's hitting a lot of nails on the head with those remarks. I mentioned in my article for the Good Fight, and when I was talking about Harper a minute ago, she's right. The Phillies don't have that young superstar. It's Harper. Harper's that guy. I hope Aiden Miller turns into a star. I hope Justin Crawford turns into a star. I hope, you know, maybe somebody else like Gabriel Rinconis finds another gear, can learn to hit left-handed pitching and become a really good young player in the majors, but probably not going to be a James Wood or a Jackson Churio, somebody like that. I just don't see that. And I agree, they should have figured out a way to sign Jeff Hoffman. The bullpen absolutely is not deep enough, and Jeff Hoffman is thriving as the Blue Jays closer. That's going to be a tough one. All right, another email here from Hugh Anderson. He says, hi, John, Liz, and Justin. Love the podcast. What do you think should be the purpose of power rankings? Now, he sent this to us back on April 8th, so I am derelict in my duties of getting this email read in time. But he said, I was reading the Athletic's MLB power rankings for April 8th, and the staff of the Athletic is getting a lot of pushback in the comments over teams being ranked based on season projections versus being ranked based on teams' actual win-loss records over the past week. I understand why projections exist, Hugh writes, and I expect that the Braves will get their act together, even though they were very low, but we know that projections are not always right. How do you feel about power rankings shifting into being something that represents a longer narrative and no longer being about which teams are hot or cold? I remember being able to look at the rankings and find out how a team had performed over the last week. Now with rankings like these from The Athletic, I have no idea how well the Twins have been doing, for example, if I haven't been following them closely. Thanks, Hugh. This is a great thing to talk about because what are the purpose of power rankings? And it's a good question. Are power rankings, because they're weekly, should they be who had the best week last week? I think the idea for power rankings is, as of this date, we are ranking who we think the best teams in baseball are. And back when you wrote this on April 8th, you had about 2.5 weeks, maybe 3 weeks at that point, of games to go through. It might have been just 2 weeks at that point. Because it's just 2 weeks, you kind of still have to use the projections. You kind of you have to factor in the noise of the early season small sample size. Because if a team, like, let's say the Dodgers, who got off to a great start, but let's just say the Dodgers, who was the heavy preseason favorite to win the World Series, let's say they go 2-7 to start the season. Do you now drop them down to like the 26th best team in baseball? You can't do that. They're still a great team, even though they got off to a slow start. So I think early on with power rankings, you have to use some projections. You have to look at the roster. You've got to use your head a little bit and say, is there anything underlying here that got them off to a slow start? Is this team still a good team? And then you do have to weigh the results a little bit. Like, you had to knock the Braves down a little bit early in the season. Even though they got off to such a slow start, they were still ranked 10th in the Athletics rankings on April 8th. Although they had maybe like the third or fourth worst record in baseball. But you kind of had to do that. You kind of have to do that because otherwise it's going to fluctuate too wildly. And I don't think power rankings should be who had the best week the week before. As the season goes along, it becomes more cumulative. You're looking at, 2 months of data. You're looking at 10 weeks, 12 weeks. It starts to filter out some of that noise, and then I think it's easier to do power rankings. It might be wise just to not even bother with power rankings until you're a month or two into the season, until you get to the second half, maybe even. Or maybe you do a monthly power ranking. Now that we've reached the end of April, a monthly power ranking is probably a good idea. I may have an article for the Good Fight this week idea, and that's an idea for the Good Fight for me for this week. An April power ranking. I don't know. We'll see. I may not have the bandwidth for something that involved. But regardless, I think it's fair early in the season with power rankings to factor in projections, but that does need to go away as the season moves along, because then you start to get enough of a sample. By mid-May, by June, the teams are starting to establish who they are. Now, again, teams can go on a late season run. They figure things out like the Mets and the Tigers did last year. Teams do falter down the stretch. But generally speaking, as the season goes along, we're already seeing it with the Braves, right? I mean, the Braves got off to such a slow start. They're, almost at 500 now. They're starting to play better. They're starting to play more like the projections suggested that they would. Will they get all the way back? I don't know. They might not. But You have to do that early in the season in order to make that all work. So some great emails there to the hittinseason@billypenn.com email bag. And again, we'll answer your emails as well. And we'll do it in a more timely fashion. We'll do it in a little bit more of a timely fashion than I did. I was negligent. I was derelict in my duties as the host of the podcast to get your emails up and to have a conversation. So if you send in some emails this week, we'll tackle it on the roundtable show that we do coming up this Sunday night. So make sure to do that. hittinseason@billypenn.com. And of course, again, like I said, the voice memo. Just record some on your phone, send it to hittinseason@billypenn.com. All right. One more game in this series against the Nationals. Brad Lord, a right-hander for the Nats, will get the start. He's making his seventh start of the season, or this is his seventh game. He's 0-3 with a 4.67 ERA in 17 and a third innings, has a whip of 1.73. Oh, boy. The Phillies should... you don't sweep this team with Brad Lord getting the start. Something's wrong. Taiwan Walker gets the start for the Phillies. Again, probably will get moved to the bullpen. Oh, I forgot to mention that Ranger Suarez will be returning to the rotation on Sunday, which leaves in doubt what Taiwan Walker, what his role will be, whether they stick with the sixth man or whether they move him to the bullpen and we say goodbye to Carlos Hernandez or some other faltering right-handed reliever. But Taiwan Walker will likely be making his last start for a little while on Thursday against the Nationals, 1-2 with a 2.78 ERA. He's done an admirable job. He's not a great pitcher, but he held down the fort until Ranger Suarez got back. But now you've got the Phillies at their peak capacity here. They're a really healthy team right now. They, knock on wood, Brandon Marsh aside, have managed to avoid injuries here through the first part of the season. They've just underachieved a little bit offensively and in the back in the bullpen, Aaron Nola a little bit, but getting Ranger Suarez back should be a nice boost for this starting rotation. And now you've got this supposed super rotation. Everybody's healthy. We'll see for how long, but kind of exciting stuff. But the Phillies and Nationals will get underway. Again, it's a 6:45 Eastern time start on Thursday night. So a night game for the series finale between the Phillies and the Nationals to wrap things up. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Want to remind you and ask you all to check out my stuff over at thegoodfight.com. Check out everything we got going on over at thegoodfight.com. Lots of great content. We're churning out content at a ridiculous pace here in 2025. So please do that for us. And also want to encourage you to listen to the end of week podcast with Justin and Liz. It'll come out on Friday. Leave a 5-star rating and a review for this podcast over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you do listen to your podcast. The Phillies are going to win the World Series this year, guys. They are going to do it. You can see they're playing better. They're going to win the World Series. So tell your friends and family about this podcast so that they can join in on the fun right now. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.